Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by the broadcaster Faye Carruthers, by Glenn Moore, women's football columnist for World Soccer, and by Sophie Downey from Girls on the Ball. Phil Neville has a two-track mind. He has to tiptoe through the political minefield of picking a GB team for next year's Olympics. And he has to prepare England for the next World Cup. His immediate objective, Brazil at the Riverside on Saturday. He's got to sort that defence, hasn't he, Faye?
He really does. I spoke to him last week and he was very defensive about his defence. I put it to him that perhaps with question marks over Steph Horton and Millie Bright and their performances recently, conceding three, all from crosses against Belgium, is it time for fresh new faces? Is it time to really put some faith in Leah Williamson? And he was very protective. And I wonder whether that loyalty might cause him problems in the future.
Mm. Is there a sense, Glenn, that Steph Horton, who is totemic within that team, is almost being overused by both club and country?
Well, she's obviously a very crucial player for both teams. And I think sometimes you do get the sense of how important she is when she's not playing for those teams. I don't think Steph's a problem, to be honest, though, like everyone else, the form goes up and down. And there are a couple of goals that she's been at fault for, giving the ball away. But when she's absent, you can see her leadership is lost. So I think she's not necessarily the problem. It's surprising, particularly obviously Phil's background in defending, that we do concede so many goals from crosses in the air. I mean, he brought back Millie partly, I think, for her aerial dominance. But there's also the sense of organisation. I mean, I don't think there's a better head of the ball defensively in the WSL than Millie Bright. But I guess she has to be in the right position to be under the ball, you know, or there's only one player there, you've got other players as well. So it's complicated. It's odd that they keep conceding so many goals and set pieces.
Mm. What about Lucy Bronze? Is she being best utilised? You know, obviously, we're all aware of the talent and, you know, the magnitude of the impact she's making globally. Are we getting the best out of her at England level?
I think she's one of the best, if not the best, right-back in the world at the moment. I do sort of understand why he's testing her in midfield at the moment. In the times where she's played in central midfield, midfield's been a bit lacking. Like last time out, it was without Jill Scott. At the Jubilees Cup, we were also without a few players. So I think, and as you look at towards the Olympics as well, when you are going to, he's going to have to take an 18-player squad, players will have to be able to fit in if someone gets injured. I get why he's testing in these games, in the friendlies, where it doesn't really matter. But I don't think we'll see it at a tournament.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Olympics, midfield is an area that shouldn't be a problem. The most likely players outside of England to come into the squad are mainly midfielders, Jess Fishlock, Caroline Weir, Kim Little, whereas there don't appear to be too many outstanding fullbacks in the other countries.
You know, I talked about a political minefield with the Olympics, and you know, it is full of people in blazers who basically say, we are going to do it like we always do it. Mm. How difficult is it? Will there be any, or can there be any tokenism in the selection?
No, I don't think there can. And Phil Neville has come out and said that. He has said, I'm going to pick the best team to go and win gold at the Olympics. And if that upsets people and doesn't cover all the nations, then so be it. And I think with my selfish hat, I'd love to see them have gold around their necks. I think that's the right decision.
What about, in the broader terms, what impact would an Olympic victory have over here?
Well, I think the Olympics in women's football has always been up there with the World Cup. It's been one of the most important tournaments. And it's been a real shame that we haven't, and well, since 2012 and before 2012, haven't had that presence there, because it is a major competition. I think it would do wonders. It would just keep this momentum going that we've had and going into the Euros in 2021. If they came home with a gold medal around their necks, imagine what that could do for the game in this country.
Also, but the BBC will give it huge coverage. I mean, they give the Olympics massive coverage when they have it. And the combination of that coverage plus football as well, it will get huge penetration into an area that women's football doesn't normally go into.
Mm. You mentioned you saw Phil Neville last week, Faye. What's your sense of how he's developed as a coach and a manager in the time he's got the job? You know, because there were a lot of doubts about him when he started. Has he answered those doubts?
I think so, with some results. I think there's still massive questions there. I think Phil's biggest problem is that sometimes he's so desperate to get across what he's trying to do and that he's trying to do something different and that everybody is working together, that sometimes he trips himself up when he's talking. And there have been a few clangers, and that can be a worry. That gets unnecessary focus on him when he doesn't really need it. And he says a lot of things, then contradicts himself. And again, that's incredibly frustrating. Like, he's talking at the moment, Sophie was saying about Lucy Bronze being used in midfield, and she can understand why, with 18 going to the Olympics. And I understand that as well. But in that case, he's also come out and said that in these friendlies, he wants to experiment. And it's a great opportunity for them to be able to do that because they don't have any qualifiers for Euro 2021, being the host nation. So why is he not trying out other combinations in defence? That, to me, doesn't make any sense and completely contradicts what he's saying.
Because that's an interesting area, because, you know, because we're hosting, we've got a diet of friendlies. Now, I thought it was a very interesting interview with Lucy Bronze last week, where she talked about we need to be better prepared for the biggest games. So by definition, England are at a disadvantage, aren't they? Because they can't.
I think, well, yeah, you don't have any competitive games, really, apart from the Olympics from now until Euro 2021. But I think you can find a quality in opposition that, while it's not at a competitive level, something like the Shibboleths Cup, which is competitive when you're there, it's against the best teams in the world, it's against the USA, you're getting that kind of experience. Yes, nothing can sort of replicate a tournament environment, but I think that's probably as close as you can get to it. Just the fact that you have three games in about 6 days. You're travelling a lot, you're on the go, the weather is crazy at that time of year. So I think that's those kind of situations, is you have to try and find the friendlies that can replicate that as much as possible.
Yeah, and let's be honest, most of those qualifiers are not competitive games. England will win almost all of the games in qualifying. They've been with one other team. Last time it was Wales, previous time it was Belgium, who they have to beat. And the rest of them is just a matter of how many. So their friendlies should be more competitive opposition. It's just a question of trying to make it mean enough. And I guess when you've got the incentive of Olympic qualification, or qualifying to get in the team for the Olympics, that should get the players sufficiently motivated.
You've got Brazil and then Portugal on the following Tuesday. What type of opposition will they represent?
Well, Brazil came here last year, so it's surprising that they come back, particularly since last year they came to Nottingham when the weather was horrible and they didn't look terribly interested, and Marta did about 15 minutes and then, oh, I've got a strain, off I go. So they're taking them to Middlesbrough this year, which sure will be lovely in October. But in both cases, I think we're looking at opposition who will keep the ball well. And that's something obviously Phil's trying to bring into the side. I mean, there's a question, as Faye was saying, about have the team progressed under Phil compared to where they would have been under Mark? And I think the answer is we don't really know. Results have been very similar. They are playing more expansive football, and that's obviously something he's looking to do. So, you know, the pressing game, keeping the ball against opposition is technically good. So in that respect, these two fixtures should be quite useful.
I think we've seen over the last year that expansive football that you're talking about is definitely much more prevalent than it used to be. We used to be very solid at the back, and now you're seeing that attacking play a lot more. I think the friendly last year and the one against Australia a couple of days afterwards, I saw some of the best football I've ever seen England play in that game. It's just a question of doing that consistently. Now, you've got it, you're starting to see it coming through. I think we saw it against Norway in the World Cup especially. Yeah, it's just about making that consistent.
It's a shame we then played Norway in a friendly and ruined that, because that was the best game of the World Cup. And then you want progression and we went backwards.
Yeah. The big friend is Germany. Yeah, Wembley. That was a huge friendly in development of the previous team, because it made Mark Sampson think we can't afford to go out and attack these teams, we have to defend. And he was right at the development of the team at the time. But England then had a very sort of reactive game for the next 2 years. So it'd be interesting where we are, and indeed where they are, for that Burnley.
Well, it looks like about 25,000 at Middlesbrough. You're going to get 60-plus at Wembley. And that's the type of fixture that make people sit up and notice, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. My sister messaged me the other day saying, I've bought tickets. I got you one as well. I said, well, I'll be there already. but my niece and nephew, I took them to their first football game. They're 12 and 9. And I took them to their first football game a couple of weeks ago and they were enthralled. They absolutely loved it, the atmosphere. It was a Tuesday night game as well, so not even great. I won't tell you the team because it's not my team. It wasn't my choice of where I was going to take them. But they're really excited. They've always wanted to go to Wembley. And so it's similar to what we were talking about before we came on air, which was a lot of people want to go and see these big stadiums and give their kids or even adults who don't get the opportunity, can't afford perhaps to go to any of the big games, to go and see these big stadiums and see professional footballers ply their trade in these big stadiums. And yeah, I think it'll be a fabulous atmosphere.
I think you are seeing it change as well. I definitely felt it over the World Cup, is where people who hadn't really been into football, definitely not women's football, but has sort of been felt a bit on the sidelines with football as a whole, suddenly watched it on the BBC. They saw it was there for them to consume, and they can consume every game. And they suddenly was like, this could be the sport for me. And they saw something in the women's game that really drew them in and really connected.
It's interesting to say that because Phil Neville actually said in his press conference last week and clarified it again when we spoke afterwards, that he said, we've always had the youngsters. He said, there's been no question that we've had the youngsters on board and watching women's football. But what he felt the tournament in France brought was the older generation of fan that perhaps wasn't interested in women's football before. And he said that was the crucial point. Guys talking about it down the pub, watching the games down the pub. People with, you know, kids that they then want to take when they perhaps hadn't thought about taking them before, or like we saw at West Ham at the London Stadium, exactly the same kind of thing. West Ham fans and season ticket holders going to watch their club play without the definition of male or female.
When you look at women's football, it is at a crucial stage of its development, isn't it, Glenn? Does it need, now it's a bit of a hackneyed phrase, the right role models, but does it need, say, a player like Jordan Nobbs, showed her character in adversity, she came back and scored at the weekend. Do you need players like that to actually provide that bridge?
I think there are plenty of players in the women's game like that. I mean, partly because they've got a lot more life experience than most of their male counterparts, because, you know, well, the older ones obviously had jobs and things, you know, like Jill Scott, but they haven't been quite in the bubble in the same way. So they've got stories to tell, and also because they're not quite so exposed to the media, you know, those stories are fresher. So there are very much lots of players, you know, with good tales to tell. I think what it really needs, though, is success. Success creates publicity, which drives things.
What about, you know, the broader... We looked at the FIFA Best Awards, and there was a definite element of equality, and you had almost like what I would call the Rapinoe principle, that she got there and she used the platform in a positive and very strident manner. Is that where women's football is going in terms of, yes, we can actually be social influencers here?
I think, yes. I think someone like Rapinoe, she's such a character on and off the field. She's such an influential player. And I know there were questions about whether she should be talking about that stuff at the World Cup or at the awards, but when else is the camera going to be on her, firstly, in the women's game? You've got that month in June this summer where there are headlines on every page. So I don't see why not, and why not use the platform to progress the things that she feels very, very strongly about and demanding equality for the women's game.
Because there is a special platform. You saw it at West Ham on Sunday where you know they launched that charity pink kit, the third kit, for breast cancer research. That's part of the USP of women's football, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, you've seen men's football use, you know, for whatever platform they want to use it for, why not with women's football? And particularly the breast cancer awareness, there was a whole screening with, I can't remember the presenter's name, Emma Willis, on there. The advert that had been going out was screened across. You know, it's not... I don't want to use this word lightly. It's not palatable to some people when you hear, you know, talking about prostate cancer, talking about breast cancer. Some people just don't like that. But when you've got a captive audience in front of you who are people who that might be useful to. Why on earth would you not do it?
Yeah, clubs in the men's game have been very good like that. It's quite rare for a male sports person in the UK, though, to say anything politically or publicly. Much more the case in America at the moment. And it's a good opportunity. I mean, there is a platform there to push things.
What about, let's look at, on the flip side of that, the dangers of, you know, FIFA have got involved. They've obviously seen the potential. They've seen the commercial potential of it. And they're now looking at almost tinkering with competitive structures. Is that part of the danger that faces women's football? That maybe they're going to get, or the game is going to get swept along by political imperatives?
Well, there's a couple of issues. I mean, one, they're looking at expanding the World Cup. I personally think that's too soon. I don't think the depth is there for 32 teams, and you're going to get too many heavily one-sided games, which won't do anybody any good. And the other thing is obviously the idea of a Club World Cup competition, which they've met a lot of resistance in the men's game about expanding it. There's a sense there of FIFA doing a land grab against, say, UEFA. You know, possibly. I mean, I think that is probably quite a good thing for the women's game. It will create, you know, more coverage and prominence, and will help other areas of the world. The two drawbacks is, one, when are you going to play these games? Because the fixture list is getting quite congested. Now, of course, everyone plays at different seasons around the world. And one particular problem for, like, Australian clubs is a lot of their players are on loan from American clubs and vice versa. So if you're someone who plays for three teams, it's a bit like when cricket had international T20 competitions. You know, some people are playing for three or four teams. And not quite so bad in the women's game, but quite a lot of the good players play for two teams. I mean, who would Sam Kerr play for? Well, probably Chicago Red Stars. But so there are one or two logistical aspects to be dealt with.
Mm. What about the other aspects of the influence of the men's game? Okay, there's a trickle-down effect of finance and interest. But, you know, you saw or most pertinently heard at Lee on Saturday the flip side of that. The Hillsborough chance. Can you give us some idea of one, whether that was particularly obvious, and two, what challenges that now presents for women's football?
Well, I definitely heard the chance on Saturday. They happened several times throughout the game, and we all heard them in the area that we were in. I think with women's football, we've been blessed with this really nice atmosphere that we go to that's unsegregated, and we want to try and hold onto that as much as possible while building the game. And to me, I don't see why we can't build a really nice atmosphere in the stadiums without bringing those hostile elements into the game. I think it's about education. I think it's just about general behaviour. I mean, just common sense behaviour in a way that people don't often think about, but just making it very clear to everyone that we want fans from all areas of the game. We want fans to come over from the men's side, but you just have to behave well. That's all I say.
Yeah. Easier said than done, usually, in football, isn't it?
I think clubs are going to have to crack down very quickly, and there should be a lot more self-policing among fans as well.
Mm. Mm. You were at West Ham on Sunday, 25,000 people there.
Yeah.
As an occasion, how did it come across?
I thought it came across really well. I thought the atmosphere was great. Everybody was engaged. I think there would have been a higher attendance had the weather been better. The weather was pretty awful. And I was really impressed with what they put on. I do think that the tickets could have been priced higher than they were.
£2 about that.
£2, yeah. £1 for season ticket holders and kids. And I interviewed Jack Sullivan a week ago and talked to him about that and asked him whether they'd learnt lessons from Manchester City's pricing structure for their opening game, where 11,000 more fans turned up than they were expecting and paid on the day. And I think that was £7.50. And then Chelsea, who gave them away for free, were expecting 42,000 and actually got 25,000. And what did he learn? And he said, we've decided to pitch it at £1, £2. And I still think that they could have pitched it at £5 and had the same amount of turnout.
Because you've got the upcoming game at the Tottenham's new stadium. Again, if you're Daniel Levy, Sophie, what sort of price would you charge?
I mean, I'd go between the £5 and £10 range, to be honest. I think you can go for £10 at these big stadiums. I think going for nothing is devaluing the game. You have to put a value on the sport at this point. They're professional athletes. You're getting to go into some of the biggest stadiums in the country. You shouldn't go for free. that's my personal point of view. I think for the Tottenham game, Tottenham Arsenal, I mean, the new stadium, why not put it at £10? I think you will attract the people.
It's more expensive to go and watch West Ham at Rush Green than it is at Olympic Stadium. Mm. Yeah, and it would be, well, obviously, the Spurs don't charge like £1 for the Hive if they go there, so.
But I would say, particularly with the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, they've got an amazing opportunity because, look, you know, since that stadium has opened, social media is full of everybody just going, wow, best stadium I've ever seen in my life. People want to see that. You still have to grab those people, regardless of whether they're going to watch the game or not. They're going for the experience, and you might then get a load of people who say, actually, what an amazing product this is. This is better football than we were expecting, etc., etc. Those are the people that you have to get and make it a day.
Mm. So, in other words, make the popularity of the men's game work for you.
Mm. I mean, the attraction of the ground is a massive attraction, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I can imagine quite a lot of people would go there just to sort of see this new pint machine where it fills up on the bottom. Well, that won't be cheap. It's going to be £5-6 a pint. So why not with at least £6 a ticket?
Yeah, yeah. With, again, the broader issue of, you know, equal pay. You know, I think the Finns are trying it now. Simply because of the vast amount of money paid in the Premier League, you're never going to get equality as such. But would, over the next, say, 3 or 4 years, would a new type of player begin to emerge in terms of, you know, very professional, almost a brand in herself?
I think you're starting to see it with the players at the top now. I mean, the Steph Whartons of the world, she's incredibly marketable in herself. She is a brand. I think, yeah, it's going to get closer. I don't think anyone is asking for what the men are paid in domestic football. I think we all know that that's, they just want to be able to sustain themselves and be able to live comfortably, I think, on what, and actually be paid what they're worth. I have a different view on international football. I do think, I might be a bit radical, but I think at international level, you should be paid the same because you're appearing for your country and international organisations should pay the same. That's my personal point of view.
Of course, it's a tricky one. I mean, like England male footballers, all their money goes to charity. They don't take any basic pay. I'm not quite sure whether that would apply to how they picked up bonus for winning the World Cup. But, I mean, they don't actually receive any money directly for playing for England, though the FA do pay a fee that goes to the charity. It is a complicated one. I mean, the Americans have got a very good argument for equal pay. In the club game, clearly there isn't because it's not generating that kind of income. And, I mean, whilst a lot of sympathy for the idea that, you know, people are professionals and working very hard and so on, that also applies to hockey players. They're not getting any money. Mm. I mean, lots of sports people are highly professional, put a huge amount of their own time in, and they don't get any money because their sport doesn't attract that many fans. The sport has to attract more fans to justify paying more money.
But you've also then, you know, got the commercial element to it, where someone like, you know, Nike have said that they sold 4 more times the amount of gear than they did in 2015 as compared to 2019.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think finally brands are starting to realise, you know, you've got a number of them, I won't list them all, but a number of the Lionesses have got commercial deals with partners, and you are seeing brands realising the potential of female role models, because that's what these women are, they're role models to the younger generation, and that is exactly what brands are looking for to represent them.
Mm. That could be the growth area for income, and also television. I mean, the French lights have gone out for the next Euros, and the current round of bidding is at least twice what they paid for this round of Euros.
From a journalist perspective, what are the current generation of players like to deal with? Are they quite accessible and eager to tell their stories?
I would say yes. I think they're very willing and quite open about what they're ready to talk to you about. They know where they've come from or where the generation before them have come from. And that was the connection with people, with the media, with the fans. And it's something that's very, I think, quite unique to the women's game, is that connection between people. I haven't encountered... I mean, I think they're very willing to help. And
I've not had any resistance at all. People, you know, if there's something they perhaps don't want to talk about, they'll maybe say beforehand, you know, what, can we not touch on that? Mm. Which is absolutely fine. They're well within their rights to do that. But I think you know, there are some players who absolutely know the importance of the media and getting the media on side, getting their name out there as well. You know, there are more who are, you know, more willing to put themselves out there than others. Others, but that's the same in men's football. There are men's footballers who like their private life and like to keep themselves to themselves. But, you know, there are certainly plenty of women out there who really want to get, you know, their names out there and become a role model for these young girls.
Well, Woods access is getting slightly harder on the bigger clubs as they become more professional, as media departments are taken over by people who work across both genders. And as demands increase, obviously. And I would also say, in defence of the men, most of the time we speak to men players, they're great and they're quite happy to talk to you. The problem is actually getting access, not the players themselves.
But I think that's a good thing, because the one thing I was worried about in the WSL, and there have been a couple of instances, you know, we saw with Casey Stoney being taken to her press conference in that opening game, Manchester Derby. It has to be as professional as you see elsewhere. You know, the press officers need to know what their role is in making the players accessible, the managers accessible and things like that. That has to be better. And I think they are learning that.
Mm. And given them their due, the FA are doing a good job in the promotion. You know, the streamers, you were saying, you know, you watched all the games.
Yeah, I was at home yesterday watching every game from the one on the Championship to all of the WSL games yesterday. It's great. It just opens it. There's no geo block. It opens up to a huge audience. You can watch it across the world. That kind of access is just incredible and I think incredibly valuable in the future. Such a good resource.
Do you think, do you see the WSL developing and evolving into the best league in the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's already the only professional women's league in Europe. You're seeing with the amount of international players that are coming over here, and that only enhances the brand, if you like to call it that. It depends where you're at with football. I know, I hate it. You know, we're all working in football. Most of us are football purists. We work in it because we love the game. But unfortunately, now that comes hand in hand. And if you want to grow the game, it has to be, you know, you have to see it like a brand, if you like. And certainly the Barclays FAWSL, as it is now called, is becoming massive. So, yeah, I absolutely do.
Yeah. When the WSL resumes on the 12th and 13th of October, Arsenal-Chelsea leaps out at you. Where does that balance of power now lie, do you think?
Well, the season's been quite interesting so far. You just say it still looks like Arsenal, Chelsea and City, Manchester City will be the three top sides. And Arsenal strengthened their squad, but they've got European commitments. Chelsea, I think, have regained a bit of focus after last year, tightened their squad a little, haven't got European commitments. So for all three teams, I think it's going to be quite close right to the end. And, you know, the problem is you have one little run of bad form and then you drop off. But I don't think it's quite the stage. The second tier of clubs are getting closer, but I think it's only Birmingham beating Chelsea last year was, I think, the only time in something like the last 30-odd meetings that the top three haven't won those games against the others.
Mm. How do you see it all going, Sophie?
I think it's definitely more competitive this year than ever before, and you are seeing that the likes of Spurs and West Ham even, they are making it harder for teams. West Ham against Arsenal in the first game of the season, that was a tight game. I would say that watching Arsenal yesterday, I think they're beginning to hit their stride, and that must be worrying for some of the other teams around. But Chelsea won big as well. It is getting more competitive, it's getting more, you can't really call it, but I do think those top three are probably, as Glenn says, the ones who will come away with it in the
end. You saw Spurs. How impressed were you by them?
Because very. I've seen them twice this season because I saw them on the opening day against Chelsea and, you know, they held Chelsea to just conceding one goal and they were very, very impressive. They were without Gemma Davidson, who has been their star performer, I would say, so far, and they still were absolutely excellent. Rosella Ryan, in particular, down the left-hand side, was creating everything. I thought they were well worth their win yesterday. And I think that the most pleasing thing is that most people had written them off at the beginning of the season purely because they'd come up, you know, second place and, you know, people were expecting them to struggle. And what Karen Hills and Juan Amoros have done is fantastic. And I really hope they keep pushing the so-called bigger sides, if you like, and can really do something this season.
Mm. So much depends on the coach, you know, men's or women's game. Joe Montemurro at Arsenal, very impressive guy, mm-hmm. affable, but you know, very intelligent and great experience. That makes him an important commodity around the world. Do you expect him to go to the US team?
Well, Arsenal reportedly have knocked back an approach. You would imagine Joe's still relatively young, that he might want to prefer the day-to-day stuff, and for a few more years, but it'd be very hard to turn down America, particularly in Olympic year coming up. And the American team plays so often, it's almost like a club job, because they are on the road a huge amount for an international team. But he has signed quite a long contract at Arsenal, so he's under contract and Arsenal could keep him. But then, do you want to keep an unhappy manager? It's a difficult one, but this is the problem, you know. It's one of the great things, if you're successful, people want your manager and your players.
Mm. What are the defining characteristics of this Arsenal team? Is it a better team than the team that won the title?
Yes, they've strengthened. I think at times last year they could barely name a bench because of the injuries, and it was quite a small squad. So while they played extremely well and they dominated the league, it was they were on a bit of a string in terms of injuries. This year they've strengthened. They've got the best striker in the world, I think, at the moment, in Vivian Miedema.
FIFA didn't get him. She wasn't in the team there, which is bizarre,
wasn't
it?
I think many of us would disagree with that, yeah. Because, I mean, she's unbelievable. She's 22. She's broken the Dutch scoring record at that age. She was top scorer last year in the WSL. She just scores for fun, that girl. It's scary and creates. Yeah, yesterday in Arsenal's win, she was involved in every goal, both scoring one and then assisting.
Well, getting back to Joe, he obviously enjoys managing here. He's got great facilities at Arsenal, good backing from the club. He's an Arsenal fan from boyhood, but he's portable, and his family still live in Australia because his kids are at school. So it's not as if he's got roots in the UK as such, and he could just as easy live in America as he could in them. As in England, if you're a family in Australia. So, yeah, in that respect, it's going to be interesting to see how that develops.
Mm. With Emma Hayes, I get, you know, she's a very driven personality. How much did the season, last season, hurt her?
I think it hurt her, but, you know, she had other things going on.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
You know, and I think it's made her more determined this year, therefore more frustrated with a couple of the results they've had. It's made her more determined to make this a successful season. And, yeah, as you say, she is very driven. I think once they start clicking a bit more, I think it was a really good confidence-boosting win yesterday. That was their most convincing win this season. You know, they'll have been... Well, I know she was very disappointed about the draw with Brighton the week before. But I think in terms of where Chelsea go this season, both Sophie and Glenn, you know, mentioned that they've got no Champions League football this season. And so if they can't, you know, push for the title then she'll be very unhappy.
Mm. We've been talking about the next generation of talent, of coaching talent, and Casey Stoney is probably the first name that gets mentioned. What are her defining characteristics, do you think, Sophie?
I think, well, first of all, she's played the game. She's done it all, as it were. And I think she commands that respect with players that come through that know that she has been there and done it. I think she has a very good knowledge and football brain. I could listen to her for a long time talk about football because she knows the tactics, she knows very well, and she knows that she's developing herself. She's well aware of her own progression. She knows she's a young manager. She knows that she's not there yet, that she needs to get there. I think she said to us on Saturday that she's learning a lot along the way from what she's been in the job 15 months now. So it's still a learning process for her, but she's in the best place to do it, I think, being at Man United, because they've given her that space to grow with the team. She commands the respect of most players, I think.
Mm, yeah, well, Manchester United is all about icons, you know, for the men's team. Although that might be on a bit of a bit wavering at the moment. I was hugely impressed by Lauren James, 18 on Sunday. The turn for the goal that she scored was fantastic. How good is she?
Very good. I mean, she's very young, obviously football family. Her brother Rhys doing well at Chelsea. It's one of those situations where, as long as, you know, she's well advised and stays fit and all those things, you know, the sky's the limit.
Mm. I saw her play in her debut for Arsenal against Millwall, and she came on the pitch at 16, and we were all like, that kid. I mean, she just was breezing past players. I think it's about, for her, it's more about the focus and her mentality, because she just needs to make sure that she's being, it's competitive enough for her to drive for those targets that she's got to aim for, because she could become one of the best players this country has seen.
Yeah, but it's funny, because you sort of assume as the game matures, there'd be less players coming in at 15, 16, 17, like a lot of the current England players did, because obviously the standard would be higher. But there are still players coming through. I mean, look at Mary Fowler in Australia. Yeah, so there are still players coming through at still a very young age.
Mm. I think we'll see more and more of that, actually, in the future, because, you know, still the current crop of the older Lionesses, you know, they were still having to travel massive distances to go and train when they were, you know, a younger age. Now that the clubs have got fantastic academies, players are playing and being coached properly at a very young age, I think we're going to see more and more young talent coming up.
Also, I mean, girls obviously do develop physically quicker than boys. You know, if you see in other sports like tennis, you know, younger players come through younger in the female side of the game than they do in the men's side.
Mm. Let's look at Liverpool. You know, you saw them. That's a huge defeat for them, you know, both in sort of almost symbolic terms, losing to Manchester United. Mm. Where does that defeat, well, leaves them bottom of the table at the moment, but where does that leave Liverpool?
I think Vicky Jepson has quite a task on hands. I mean, you look at that squad of players and there's some very, very good players in and amongst that. They just need to click, and they're not doing that at the moment. They played really well in the first half, I thought, on Saturday. They just couldn't capitalise on the chances that they did get. And then they came out the second half and they just didn't perform. So I think that would be hugely frustrating for them. But I think she's building something new there. Liverpool were under Matt Beard when he won the titles. They were very at the top of the game. Then they definitely dipped massively. And you never quite knew what the relationship with the men's side and the women's side were. I think you're starting to get a bit more of a one-club feel around it again. She came in halfway through last year or something. She needs some time to get that squad back into shape.
Yeah, the help, both on a financial and almost like a strategic level, from the men's club could actually work in their favour.
Yeah, Liverpool are a very good example of the advantages and dangers of becoming reliant on the men's clubs, which the women's game has now moved towards largely being. I mean, I know Durham are doing well, for example, but in the Championship. But, yeah, as we've seen in the past with Charlton, Notts County and so on, you know, you are very much at the whim of the men's club funding once you get to this sort of level of funding, because it's all basically being subsidised. So Liverpool, for a couple of years, really suddenly made a big effort. When Matt went there and Lucy Bonds went there and several other players, they invested heavily. They got ahead of the game in terms of most clubs, in terms of their support off the pitch, or, you know, physios and, you know, that sort of stuff. And they massively increased their staff, and they were the best team in the country for a couple of years. Then the management appeared to lose interest, and you end up with Matt Beard's wife washing the kit, you know, a year or so later. And now suddenly, you know, it looks like they're picking up again. You would have thought we're American owners, as at Villa, the women's game is bigger there, and therefore there might be a bit more buzz. And certainly this year, when they went together on tour to the States, when they travelled together, that was a sign, perhaps, that they are thinking, well, we are one club. And certainly Everton are very much doing that now. I mean, across the city, we're dropping the women's name, just calling the women's team Everton. Mm.
We haven't mentioned Manchester City. You know, 100% in the Super League. They're playing probably one of the ties of the round in the last 16 in the Champions League against Atletico Madrid. That's one to look forward to, isn't it?
Very much so. Toni Duggan going back against her former club. Yeah, definitely one to look forward to, and a real test for City as well. I think they were knocked out by Atletico at the last 32 stage last season. So they'll want to, you know, they've already gone one better. They want to go even further, and it'll be a really good test, I think, for Nick Cushing's side.
Mm. You know, we look at the men's team at City, and, you know, they've got a strategic objective to win the Champions League. Is that similar with the women's side?
Well, I think they'd love to do it first. And they've got the, you know, Atletico are the Spanish champions, but they've had a bad start to the season, heavily beaten by Barcelona in the big match over there. I think they'd love to do it first, wouldn't you? You know, Nick Cushing to beat Guardiola to the big trophy.
Yeah.
And he's under a bit of pressure to get a trophy.
And Arsenal, you know, with respect, have probably got an easier tie, Slavia Prague.
Yeah, I think they'll be breathing a big sigh of relief there because they were unseeded, so they could have got Lyon or Wolfsburg or PSG, which I think would have been very tricky at this time of year. So I think they'll definitely be happy with that one.
Yeah. Can you, we've got Glasgow City as well, we've got to mention them. They've got probably the best draw that they could have got in terms of Bromley with the lowest seeded team. What's the sort of state of play in Scotland in terms of the women's game, do you think?
There is quite a lot of investment starting to come in. I think Celtic are going to go full-time, I'm saying, and the bigger clubs are getting involved, but Glasgow City is still the senior club. But there is more investment coming in, and the success of the Scotland team reaching the finals, the World Cup finals, was clearly a big impetus. I mean, I think the government underfunded the Scottish-based players full-time for a while, but certainly at the moment, most of the better players will still come south.
OK.
Glasgow have won everything, but Hibs are starting to come through. They won the Scottish Cup, I think, last year. They're starting to challenge Glasgow for that place at the top. They were in the Champions League in the last round. They were well beaten, but I was up there for their home game, and they played really well. So it was a really good experience for them, I think, for next year if they get there. They'll take a lot from that.
Mm. So as a sort of, to bring all this together, I suppose one question really. Is it realistic to expect an English club, i.e. City or Arsenal, to overcome Lyon, who have basically won it for fun for so many years?
Well, they're going for their fifth in a row, aren't they, Lyon? And you wonder, yes, they'll probably want, you know, would that be a record?
Yes.
Five in a row? It would be.
Yeah.
So, you know, they'll want that record, but could an element of complacency come into it? That they're assuming so? Might they underestimate someone?
Chelsea pushed them very close last time. Mm. I mean, I was at the game at King's Meadow and, yeah, Lyon really had to work hard to hang in there to get through.
Mm.
I think it's getting closer. I think Lyon have had the head start in terms of their investment for so long, but it's definitely getting closer and closer now.
True enough. Can anyone stop Lyon winning for a record seventh time? Probably not. But City could be the best of the rest. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.